This episode of This Week in Radio Tech is sponsored exclusively by Omnia. Compare any other new processor on the market to the Omnia 6, but if you really want to stand above the crowd, check out the Omnia 11. On the web at omniaaudio.com.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
Yeah, we're thinking of taking over all of Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, and most of Canada. No.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And with icicles hanging from his beard, Rich Parker joins us from Vermont, along with Tom Ray and Chris Tobin.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hello, I'm Kirk Harnack. This is the show where you're going to hear all about radio technology. And that could be a lot of things. You know, that's not just audio and turntables. That could be anything from the microphone, the ribbon inside the microphone, or the diaphragm, to the mic preamp circuit. Some of those are pretty esoteric. Audio consoles, routing, digital, analog, IP audio, audio processing, transmitters, modulators, coax, and even antennas, and getting it to you, the listener, at home over the air. Yes, the one medium that seems to work when all else fails. It's radio, and I'm joined by a couple of regulars here on the show tonight, and a special guest. So let's first of all check in with our regulars from the Hudson Valley of New York. It's Tom Ray, just in from the snow. Hey, Tom.
Which is a real good thing, because I'm also the guy who did not have to strangle a groundhog today because he did not see a shadow.
Well, now why would you strangle? Now, does that mean we get a shorter winter?
Yes, we got a shorter winter because he did not see the shadow. I'm done with winter. I've had it with winter. Had plenty of snow, had too much. Don't want to go there again.
Gotcha. Well, you won't have any more, according to Punxsutawney Phil. Apparently,
and Staten Island Chuck.
Ah.
We beat the mayor of New York a couple of years ago. It was great. Anyway, I'm the VP of Engineering of Buckley Broadcasting and WOR in New York, and greetings.
And greetings to you, too. Appreciate it. We're going to hear a couple of your snow stories here shortly. Also with us, the best-dressed engineer in radio from downtown Manhattan, it's Chris Tope. Hi, Chris.
Good evening, everyone. I'm a broadcast technologist at CBS Radio here in New York City. 3 AMs, 3 FMs, and right now we're experiencing a little bit of rain and warm weather. It's melting all the snow, flooding everywhere. But other than that, it's been a great day.
You know, I was talking to Rich Parker earlier today about you, Chris Tobin, and you know, Rich was telling me about these mountains that he has to climb and, you know, take four-wheel drives and who knows what kind of vehicles up these things. And here you are. You take the elevator to the 87th floor to check on your transmitters.
That's true. We do take an elevator. It's convenient. We don't have to go outside. Everything is... Well, that's for the FMs. Our AMs are outside. And today we did have ice sliding down the guy wires, and we did have chunks of ice land on one of the vehicles at the transmitter site. So, yeah, we do have some outdoors. Okay. Oh, yes. There's a unique set of ice on the roof of a car.
Tom, do you have something to say?
No, just ooh.
Ooh.
Yeah, okay, I
want to bring in our guest on the show today. By the way, Chris Tarr is snowed under. He's been like awake for 48 hours straight, keeping transmitters on the air. And he said, I'm just not going to be there tonight. You guys just carry on without me. So we're going to carry on without Chris Tarr. Although, you know, I'll be seeing Chris a couple weeks from now. Actually, we may end up trying to do the show from one of Chris's studios. So that might be kind of cool. Anyway, our guest is Rich Parker from Vermont Public Radio. Hello, Rich.
Hey, everybody. I just want to point out that no elevators, but we can easily find a parking place.
you have, Vermont is a small state, but you have plenty of parking.
Exactly. As long as there's a place to unload the snowmobile or the ATV with tracks, we're fine.
So, Rich, you are the director of engineering for a prestigious organization, Vermont Public Radio. Tell us a little bit about what you do there as DOE.
Wow. Well, we have a number of transmitters all over the state. A large portion of them are on mountains above 2,500 feet. One, our highest is 4,000 feet on Mount Mansfield. As you can imagine, this time of year, it is somewhat challenging to reach the sites. And as I said, we use a combination of snowmobiles and tracked ATV vehicles to reach those sites.
Wow. Where do you get a tracked ATV vehicle? Is this something that you can find pretty easily in Vermont?
Well, we use the ATVs in the summer and different times of the year, and there is a modification to the ATV that it kind of looks like a lunar module or a Mars lander. It has four diagonal tracks that go where the wheels were, and it takes you up. So it's pretty good.
Cool. All right. So we're recording this show in the aftermath of snowstorms. Let's see, the third largest snowstorm in history for Chicago. In fact, this morning I was talking to a well-known Chicago engineer, Mike McCarthy, and he takes care of some AM stations there, and I believe a couple of FMs as well. And Mike said he had over 20 inches of snow at his house close to O'Hare Airport, and third largest snowstorm in history. But he said he really didn't have any stations off the air. A couple of satellite dishes ended up getting some snow, but it wasn't the kind of snow that was sticking a whole lot, so a whole lot of blowing snow. Chris Tarr, as I mentioned, worked all day for 2 days and overnight as well. He was posting updates on Twitter and Facebook, trying to sleep a little bit overnight last night, and just couldn't, had too much going on. So, Tom Ray, what was going on in New York City with the big WOR station there?
Well, we have a unique antenna system. First of all, we have tall towers; they're 171 degrees, but because of our proximity in the Meadowlands over in New Jersey, we've got 4, maybe 5 AM transmitter sites, and we're all kind of tucked right in there within a mile and a half of each other. And what happens with AM is when you have a directional antenna system, even though our towers and 1010 Winds, where Chris works, happens to be one of our neighbors, even though our towers are not part of 1010 Winds antenna system, we can interact with each other. So to do that, we have to detune the antennas. And in the case of WOR, because we are running almost half wave towers for 710, they are almost 700 feet tall. And at 1010 and 1190, which is one of the other stations, they are overly tall for detuning. So what we do is we have two sets of skirts, one on the top, one near the bottom of the tower, that electrically shorten the tower to make it a lot easier to handle the reactances at the bottom of the tower so we can detune it. And, you know, during normal operation, these skirts are not part of the 710 circuit, and, you know, they're kind of irrelevant to 710, but they do a great job detuning for 1190 and 1010. When we ice up like we did today, and when I got to the transmitter site this morning, I had almost a quarter inch snow on the fence at the transmitter site. So if I had a quarter inch 18 feet above sea level, which is where the fence is, I can just imagine what it was 600 feet up the tower. And what happens is, of course, the ice coats the skirt. The ice also coats the insulator. There's a fiberglass rod that insulates these skirts from the tower. Mm-hmm. And these skirts now become part of the circuit for 710, and it throws the impedance on the common point way off, because it throws the impedance on the tower way off, and which in turn throws the directional parameters out, so we end up having to reduce power to keep our monitor points in and to stay on the air. So we were almost 24 hours on reduced power, and around 3:35 this afternoon is when everything fell back into place. But nothing quite like sticking your head out the transmitter building and hearing out in the tower field, which the closest tower is about 370 feet away from the building, just hearing boom as a piece of ice comes down.
So this snow that had collected on, I was thinking especially of the horizontal insulators that hold the skirt wires out from the tower and keep them from, you know, galloping in the wind. Had this snow basically turned to ice? Because if it was just snow, Tom, you could climb the tower and blow that off yourself and be done with the problem.
Right. Well, snow's not a problem for us unless it's the really dry snow with a heavy wind, because then the towers will statically charge, because, you know, being a high voltage at the base because they're a half wave tower. But the issue for us was the ice. The storm down in New York City started as snow and then turned over to ice. And we had icing through yesterday afternoon all the way through this morning. I got to the site about 10:45, 11 o'clock this morning. And when I got to the site, the temperature was going up. By noon, it was 40 degrees, and the ice was falling off the building, falling off the tower, falling off the guy wires, falling off the skirts. So that was rather unique.
So did the ice end up doing any damage, that falling ice?
I didn't see any. You know, the guy wires and stuff are far enough from the building where, and we didn't really have any wind today, so it wouldn't have picked anything up. If anything, it ripped the gutters off the front of the building, so I'll have to, you know, work on putting those back up when springtime comes. But besides that, no, and I haven't been able to get out to the tuning houses, so I don't know if there's any real damage out on one of the tuning houses, but the bottom line is everything fell back into place, so I know there's no damage in a tuning house. So,
you know, Tom, you actually brought up a subject a few minutes ago that I never realized about your tower site. I thought that all you had to do with regard to the other 50 kilowatt, the other high power AM transmitter sites in the Meadowlands, you know, within a stone's throw or two of your transmitter site, was to trap the received signal from those out before it got into your transmitter. So you would just have traps in your tuning houses or at your common point area or something like that. But there's more to it than that. As you alluded to, you actually have to detune the towers themselves so that they are basically invisible, completely non-resonant, and don't re-radiate any signal that hits them on these other frequencies. Have I got that part of it right?
Yes, you're correct. And, you know, at 1190, which is WLIB, and at 1010 winds, and especially on the 620, we don't have a skirt for 620 because, of course, we're slightly shorter than half-wave towers for 620. But we all have somewhat critical nulls behind our arrays, and we all do interact. And as a matter of fact, it's Chris, if I'm not mistaken, Chris, you can pretty much tell when if I short a tower out because I short out the detuning doing that, and you probably see a minor change in your antenna monitor, and vice versa. I can tell when Chris is doing things and when LIB is doing something, and it gets a little crazy out there, you know, because we are close together, and so because we are close together, we will interact.
The other half that actually I want to follow up on, and then we'll let Chris comment, is that your towers at 710 kilohertz are pretty tall because you said they're nearly a half wave tall. And I think you said they were what, 700 and some feet tall? Is that right?
They are actually 669 feet, which is 171 electrical degrees at 710.
Okay. Anyway, they're tall. Okay, so almost 70 stories tall are your towers. And however, this is too tall to with one connection, with one skirt, detune them for the higher frequency stations that are around you. And so you said there was an upper skirt and a lower skirt. So it actually takes a lot of science, math, and apparatus and tuning to make those towers invisible to the other stations that are near you that are on higher frequencies, right?
That's correct, and the you know, we also detune for 620, but like I said, we don't need a skirt for them because the towers are short enough at that frequency. What happens with these towers is the reason for the skirts, we need to electrically shorten the tower. The reason being is we would need a heck of a lot bigger tuning house because the reactance created reactance that would be needed to cancel out and make the tower invisible, let's say at 1010, would be a tremendous amount if we didn't shorten the tower because the tower is way over tall. So that's why we have the skirts on the tower. It also has an effect on the bandwidth on 710 and several other factors, which is why we did the skirts. And we had them on our old towers before we built this site. But it's an interesting facility, and it's an interesting process. Matter of fact, I was surprised when we were building the towers. We had a little bit of vandalism at the site, and the skirts themselves, they're made out of copper weld wire. And what copper weld is, it's steel cable that is coated with copper.
But it sure looks like copper, doesn't it?
Oh, it looks like copper. It acts like copper electrically, but it's got this steel, you know, it's got the strength of steel. Mm-hmm. And we obviously had to get a skirt up so we could start tuning, so we used a piece of guy wire. Big difference with the conductivity with a piece of guy wire and with a piece of copper weld. We were able to get the get things in place so we could tune up the antenna system fairly well, or at least start the process. And then the copper weld came in and we put that up, and then we had to go back and redo everything because it changed.
Wow. That's for those engineers who so often deal with higher frequencies and smaller antennas, even the size of an FM transmission antenna, or high, even higher than that, cell antennas, two-way radio of various frequencies, UHF antennas. It seems like, I know every antenna design might have its own challenges to take care of, but it just seems AM, which we think of as being a simplistic technology because the receivers can be fairly simplistic. Look, crystal radio can pick up WOR or WINS or my AM station in Clarksdale, Mississippi. But the technology to transmit AM in some ways is more complicated than for FM. In fact, I need to get Rich and Chris to chime in on this. But when one of the surprising things I learned as I became a more and more experienced engineer was that the AM transmitters that I was in charge of, that I took care of, that I repaired and maintained, if there was one part in them not working, chances were that the transmitter wasn't going to sound good, wasn't going to be full power. Every part had to work right in an AM transmitter. But with an FM transmitter, there's a number of parts that the transmitter seemingly can do without, at least for a little while, and it won't affect the sound of the transmitter because it's FM. That sound is pretty much dictated by the modulation circuit, and oftentimes we can operate at full power even with a part bad, missing, gone, temporarily the wrong part in there. So I found that FM transmitters and antennas just tended to be a whole lot simpler to deal with than AM did. Let's turn it over to Chris Tobin. He had something else to say too. Chris, have you found that to be the case at all?
Uh-oh. No sound from Chris.
No sound from Chris?
Look at that. How about that?
There he is.
Anyway, yes, absolutely. AM is definitely more complicated mode of transmission for us to generate compared to FM. I've had many experiences where my FM transmitters were, hobbling along and still nobody was the wiser. Whereas my AM sites, the first thing that you notice is the audio degradation, second, signal strength, signal coverage, and things of that sort. But Tom's site, which is, as the crow flies for me, half a mile, I can see his tower lights every day. And he's right. When he makes changes to his tower system, I see the reflected changes on my antenna system as well as he can see mine. When he was putting up his new towers, we were watching our parameters go back and forth, up and down. Every time the crane swung from left to right, we just sat there going, okay, this is Tom's working today. We'll leave things as they are. But there's a lot of mutual understanding out there at the Meadowlands for us.
Yeah, mutual understanding. Yeah. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, no, I didn't say anything. I'm just sitting here listening.
So, Chris, did you ever, when you have tower sites that affect each other like this, do you ever have a time when, let's say at Tom's site, there's a crane, moving around, putting up tower sections or building the transmitter building. Do you ever have an experience where it's enough of a change in your antenna system that it kicks your transmitter off? Or by this time, have you already reduced power on your transmitter so that some reflected power isn't too much for it?
We did experience a fold back where the transmitter doesn't shut down but reduces the output to sort of make up for the reflected signal coming in so it doesn't shut down, but nothing too crazy. I have worked at other broadcast facilities where, yes, the change in parameters were sufficient that the transmitter just couldn't tolerate it and would shut down. But our current site, and when Tom was doing his work, and WLIB, the other stations, and 620 as well, and even WEPN at 1050 when they were putting up their antenna system, we were impacted. Nothing went off. We just folded back, just 5% here, 10% there, momentarily. Nothing too dramatic. But thank goodness. But yes, if there was a need to, we could always roll back power and let things roll, continue on.
So bad weather, especially ice, is typically a much larger problem for FM broadcasters. And so let's bring Rich Parker back in the conversation. Rick, I'm sorry. It seems like we left you out for a few minutes. Didn't mean to. Rich,
I'm learning a lot about AM towers right now.
You take care of a number of FM stations there in Vermont. Tell us a little bit about your network and, maybe pick a site or two to describe for us and give us a feel for what you have to do, especially with bad weather.
Well, our highest site is at about 4,000 feet on Mount Mansfield, WVPS. It's a four-bay panel antenna. And when we rebuilt that site, we used large radomes on those panels because we knew it was a very hostile site, a lot of ice, a lot of rime ice, and that can be a very big problem. The reason I bring it up is that our other highest site is WVPR, which is on Mount Escutney, which is not quite as high, but it's up in around 3,500 feet. And that site is extremely hostile. That has a very similar panel antenna, but it does not have the large radomes that we have on Mount Mansfield. And as a result, we've had a fair amount of problems with that antenna. And in addition to that, there's a 12-foot microwave dish that's above us on the tower. And then, of course, at the top of the tower, Vermont Public Television has a very large TV antenna. Excuse me. So what we've noticed is ice shedding at certain times of the year, usually December and also in the spring, we get extreme amounts of ice, and then we'll get a warm spell, and the ice will shed sometimes pieces literally as large as refrigerators or perhaps even small Volkswagens that come down off of those upper areas. And they can. Right now we have a situation where we have an antenna array which has been damaged by ice, and we're waiting to be able to repair that. But there's a tremendous amount of ice on the tower itself right now, which makes it very difficult. So we have a proposal right now. There's ice guards, which are very, very heavy-duty ice guards, which are going to go above that antenna, which are on the ground under several feet of snow right now, waiting to be installed, that will help with the falls. And we also have a new antenna that's been ordered, which has the same large radomes over the elements, over the radiating elements like we have on Mount Mansfield. So it's just extremely, extremely difficult. And then our other site that presents a challenge is on Burke Mountain, which is at top of a ski resort. Right now, that's a single bay, vertically polarized antenna, and it has a, what Shively calls the Mount Washington radome. It's just a huge, huge it's like the size of a 55-gallon drum, and really it's a huge radome. And the problem there was that antenna was literally covered with ice and rime ice, and it was literally coupling back to the tower to the point that it was folding back and kicking us off. So it's just, that was a real challenge. So once we got that radome on, that helped. So you're correct that at FM frequencies, the ice can be a tremendous, tremendous problem. We have a certain amount of tolerance that the transmitters can take a certain amount of foldback, but there's a huge amount of detuning that happens to FM antennas when they get covered with ice, and eventually you just can't compensate for it. We try to reduce power, the transmitters fold back, but the only true a solution is really just very large radomes that keep the ice off of those antennas.
Hey, Rich, I've got a couple of pictures here that these are actually from VPR websites. Burke's going to put the first one up, and you can tell us what we're looking at here with this picture. It looks to be like part of a panel antenna. And Burke said he was ready with the picture. There he is. What are we looking at here, right, Rich?
Okay, that's the Mount Escutney antenna, and that is a Shively 6014 panel. It's close to 300 feet up. As you can see, those elements, really just the typical 6014, kind of an arrowhead design, those will take ice falls and will actually get hit and bent deformed, and of course, one of them is leaking very, very, very slightly. So it's it's causing a little bit of a load on our what do you call those things? compressors. Sorry, I know it's like compressors. We really are very, very hopeful that we can get a warm spell and get up there and get this replaced and get the ice guards on it, because this ice fall problem has just been ongoing. And not to blame anyone, I don't mean it that way, but we've experienced even more and more problems ever since the gigantic 12-foot microwave dish was put above us. There used to be a reflector with one of the bottom-fed microwaves that, you know, it was like a went up the tower and reflected straight out across. They replaced that with this big radome dish, and it drops a lot of ice on us right now.
Mm, okay, yeah. And there's another picture here that Burke has ready to go. This is some construction going on. Tell us what's happening here.
Right, that's the same tower. That's the Mount Ascutney Tower, and we were taking, it's hard to say, we're either taking down or putting up one of the panels that had been severely damaged in an attempt to, to fix that situation. And that's the site where, in the wintertime, we just really need to get the ice guards on there. You can see it right there where he is in the panel. You can see there's an ice guard above that microwave antenna. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you can zoom in and see that, but that thing is kind of bent, which gives you an idea of how severe that site really is. Just a tremendously severe site.
So this is the ice guard that's just above the bay, and it's intended to block ice. But of course, it catches the full brunt of it when it comes down.
Right, and so we're going to put those above the panels that are at the top of the tower to try to eliminate some of that problem.
Ah, okay.
That antenna is shared by another broadcaster as well, so it's very important that we take care of that.
Hey, we're going to continue with Rich Parker in just a moment, including a story about Mount Washington. But I want to tell you about our sponsor, the exclusive sponsor for this episode of This Week in Radio Tech, and that is Omnia. Now, you've heard of Omnia processing. Hey, maybe you're an Orban fan. Maybe you're a fan of some other audio processor. You owe it to yourself, honest to goodness. Hey, engineer to engineer, to try out an Omnia processor. Now, there's a large range of Omnia processors. You have software processors like the Omnia AXE, which is a Omnia processing for the Windows platform, plus encoding. So you can do stream encoding. Those two are perfectly matched. I use them myself at my radio stations. We have several streams going out, and they all sound so good with modern HEAAC V2 encoding and Omnia audio processing that is perfect for streaming. There's the Omnia One, available in different flavors like the Omnia One Multicast for the ultimate in streaming processing. There's also the Omnia One AM and the Omnia One FM and the Omnia One Studio Pro. Listen, over 5,000 Omnia Ones have gone out the door from Omnia. It's accepted around the world. Even huge major networks have tested all the processors that are available in that kind of price range, like under $5,000, and they've settled on the Omnia One series. Then there's the Omnia 6. That's available in the EX version and the EXI version. The I version has the built-in diversity delay if you're an HD station. Plus, it has a low IMD clipper that is really special. So the Omnia 6, and the list price on the Omnia 6 is lower than ever. It's under $10,000 U.S. You want to check that out with your local dealer, but in U.S. dollars, under $10,000 for the Omnia 6 now. Now, here's what I'm getting to. The flagship of the audio processing world, it's the Omnia 11. Folks, I've heard this thing myself. I've compared it with other processors, and I got to tell you, in terms of audio processing and hearing the differences between processors, there is no comparison. If you want to compare some other processor, some other new processor on the market to something that Omnia makes, compare it to the Omnia 6. The other new processors on the market compare just fine with the Omnia 6. But if you want to stand above that crowd, look at the Omnia 11. Give it a listen. You will not be disappointed with its sound. It is phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. And if you're not sure about making a lot of adjustments to the sound, a lot of tweaks to the processor settings, hey, what I've seen other engineers do is not have to make any adjustments to the processing. They put it on the air, they pick a preset, and they love it just the way it is. Sure, set the input level, set the output level, make sure that's right. But they are loving, engineers around the world are loving the Omnia 11 just straight out of the box. check it out with your local dealer. There is a cool special going on. If you're the first in your market to get an Omni 11, you can save yourself $2,000. That's a factory discount for being first in your market. So make your best deal with your dealer for an Omni 11, and then ask for the first in your market discount, and you'll save $2,000. It's really incredible. I guarantee that you will love it. If you want to check it out some more, go to the web. Go to omniaaudio.com/11. That would be 11. Don't spell it out. omniaaudio.com/11. And well, I appreciate very much Omnia sponsoring exclusively this episode of This Week in Radio Tech.
This is not one of your sites, this last picture, but it is just amazing. It's from Mount Washington, which is not too far from your stomping grounds. But I found a picture that's just incredible with the amount of ice up there.
Yeah, that's a fairly typical. I mean, Mount Washington's around 6,000 feet, I think. But that's a very common occurrence. Lots of rime ice, lots of ice. There's actually the U.S. Army has what they call a cold weather research station in Hanover or Lebanon, New Hampshire, and they've told me in some of their studies that the zone here on the East Coast between about 4,000 and 6,000 feet is probably some of the worst icing zone anywhere in the world. When you get into Colorado or Switzerland or some of the higher areas, what you find is that even though they're much higher, the humidity is much lower. And so you don't get the same kind of icing that you get in this zone here. That's a very typical picture. That, I mean, that could have been Arbroath Mountain. It could have been anywhere. Very, very typical, and that's very, very hard on FM antennas.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. Last picture here. With all the ice on the. Now that it looks like a two bay vertical only antenna. Whether it's FM or not, I don't know. But that's incredible build up there.
Yeah, I would say just from looking at that, it looks very much like it's probably either that or some two way sort of a UHF dipoles. But that's exactly what we're confronted with all the time. And not to give a plug for manufacturer, but there's a very famous tower manufacturer, antenna manufacturer, who uses our Matt Mansfield antenna in one of their advertisements. It's a four bay panel antenna with the radomes, and it's quite covered with ice and rime ice and in that picture. And that antenna performs very, very well under the most severe icing conditions. But I have to tell you that it has a lot to do with those radomes being on it.
Wow. Wow. So in this most recent storm, Rich, what kind of additional snow or ice did you guys get? And what have you had to do the last couple of days to take care of anything?
Well, as I said, we've been very actually fortunate in this storm. This time of year, once we've, for our size that have decent radomes, we're not really too troubled with ice buildup. What hurts us the most is if we're going to get a warm spell here, and that's when the ice falls, and that's when we get a lot of physical damage to the antennas, and that's where we need to keep beefing up those, the ice guards and things. Oddly enough, we've got some IP radios for STL type transport, and we're finding that sometimes those are affected by ice buildup. We had one this weekend. In fact, it was very difficult. The RSL, the receive level, went down to about minus 76, minus 79 dB, which 80 is pretty much fringe, and we started losing connection to our site. That has our audio over audio IP codecs and also our remote control. And what we found is what happened is we were able to get a tower rigger up there finally on Saturday. We had a little break in the weather. And he had found that the Wi-Fi, it's a 5.8 panel, it just had gotten whacked by a piece of ice, and it was just a little bit off of alignment, you know. And so the RSL went down. And, of course, then when the ice came and the rime ice came, then, of course, we just lost the signal altogether. You know, I was able to – this is the great thing about technology. I was literally sitting in my house with a cup of coffee looking through a KVM over IP at the radios, and looking at the RSL levels as he was moving it up on the tower. So I was warm and comfy with a hot cup of coffee, and he was up on the tower. You know, lucky me that time, moving the antennas and getting it, you know, lined back up. And then I could see that the received signal went, you know, up to minus 59. Which was, you know, it's plenty of margin for us. And, of course, then everything came back up. But it just points out that a combination of the ice falls, which just slightly misaligned that antenna, and then, again, the ice that was building up on it just pushed things over the margin. So it's always a challenge for us in this kind of weather. I mean, other than that, fortunately, we've been actually really we've been very, very fortunate, you know, this year in terms of just, you know, snow and ice and build up on the antennas. But the thing that's really hurt us is the Ascutney site, where we've had some really severe ice falls, which have done some quite extensive physical damage.
Hey, I've got there's a little short video here. It's only a few seconds long, if Burke can possibly to bring that up, but I'm not sure that he can. Oh, yeah, here it is. This is Rich Parker on a tower cutting ice away from it. Let's see it again, Burke. There's Rich up on the tower.
Yeah,
tell us about that, Rich. What are you doing?
That's not me, but I tell you, that's something that our riggers do have to go through, and that's just we's a tower crew from here in Vermont, and I can't say enough about those guys. One of their main climbers, Eli, I mean, if he wasn't a tower rigger, he'd be a linebacker. This man can over 6 foot, probably, I don't know, 260. He'll climb a tower with a bay slung over one shoulder and tools on his belt and just climb up that thing. And really just a very, very impressive thing to see. But it gets cold here.
Yeah. Yes, you guys are used to dealing with that. And in so much of the rest of the country, like in Oklahoma, where they got, you know, a foot of snow, I know broadcasters there and engineers there are not so accustomed to dealing with that. You know, they're accustomed to picking up the aftermath from a tornado, but not so much with trying to stay on the air during an ice storm. Wow. Hey, Chris Tobin and Tom Ray, what questions have you got for Rich? You know, he's the director of engineering for a whole public radio network in Vermont. What things are interesting to you about Rich? And hey, and I had the pleasure of spending a whole day with Rich one day a few years ago. We got to go up to Mount Ascutney and play with some audio processing. And so I try to connect with Rich at every trade show. We talk about his facilities there. What do you guys have for him?
This is Chris in New York. I'm curious. What do you got? How do you guys handle broadcast continuity or disaster recovery? You know, what is your policy as far as how you go about restoring services, say during bad weather or bad weather that introduces maybe power outages or the inability to get to the proper studios? I was just always curious how you handle that.
Well, you know, we've been growing as a network. In fact, I'm working on a report that sort of gives the sounds like a jet taking off, where we've had, kind of working on the history of what we're, where we've been, and then kind of looking towards the future, where we're going. And it's been a challenge. You know, we have a large network. We've grown very fast, but we're not in as good a shape as some of our commercial brethren, which have alternate sites. We're putting more and more backup transmitters at our sites, which is very good. But we don't really have the opportunity yet, although it's in my plans for the future, to get, you know, some backup sites. Almost all of the sites that we're at, we are co-located with Vermont Public Television or some other commercial broadcasters. So there's generally a generator there. So when we lose power, we're pretty able to, get back on the air quickly with power. We have a number of sites that have alternate feeds because we're a statewide radio network and because our sites are on very high mountains. And because, you know, Vermont, frankly, is not as big as some states. You know, I have colleagues in Colorado, Utah. It's very, very challenging. Many of our sites can hear, you know, as an off-air pickup, our other sites. So we can sometimes use off-air pickups for an alternate feed if we lost an STL. And also because we're co-located with Vermont Public Television, they have a microwave system with Interplex, basically audio codecs over T1 over the radios. And they've given us a couple of channels, so we've been able to provide some backup audio. So basically that combination is what, you know, allows us to keep continuity. our studios are in Colchester, Vermont, and that studio there has a very large generator. Most of the stuff, I think just about everything in the studios and in the term room is on UPS's. And then we have a 75 kVA a generator for the building. A few years back, you may remember that we have the huge ice storm. You know, it took out power for a lot of people for a long time. We were very fortunate because the Colchester site is actually fed by natural gas, which is not terribly common in Vermont. So the generator ran for 2 or 3 days, so we didn't have to, you know, kind of look around and try to find diesel and try to find a place that had a generator for their fuel pumps. You know, so that was good. So that's it can be challenging, but we've done a fairly good job of keeping keeping things on the air. But you're right, it can be a challenge. And I wish we had backup sites. And I think that's kind of our next step in our growth as a network.
Hey, Rich, you've got a pretty complicated network there. Each time I talk to you, it seems like you've implemented some kind of new technology or, you know, some backup in some way. You've got a combination of T1. You mentioned you had some IP radios. Talk to us for a minute about how you try to maintain audio quality, feeding the audio that you produce at Colchester to these different transmitter sites. What are some of the technology that you use? What's working for you? What do you like for a main? What do you like for a backup?
Well, we had for years used your standard T1s through a carrier, carrier here in the state, mostly over fiber. And we used, as I mentioned before, the Interplex, but there's a lot of similar devices. They're basically T1 multiplexers with different card slots to provide audio, and there's Ethernet slots for remote control and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But what we found is that it's becoming more and more cost-effective to use IP-based services. Now, because we're a small, well, relatively small state with a kind of a collegial atmosphere among a lot of people, you know, the ISPs, everybody knows each other, we can work together. We've been able to put together IP networks which have, if not guaranteed, you know, bandwidth, at least we know the T1s, the direct internet access IP T1s, you know, going from our station to the central office, you know, are not going out into the big wide internet cloud. They're basically a cable going over to another router, which goes to the cables that go to our site. So mm-hmm. even though it's not really point to point, it functions almost like that. So what we've been able to do is use IP codecs to feed our audio, and we've also been able to use lots of remote control devices. I mean, we've, in the time that I've been here, and again, this speaks to the weather and the difficulty in travel and some of the really harsh conditions at site, we have become huge proponents of well, the particular ones we use are NP-08s. They're a net booter device so that by IP we can reboot things remotely, because as more and more things become IP, everything from our transmitters to exciters to HD stuff, it's all computers, and it just, you know, ultimately has to get rebooted. We use those. We have it used to be CentiBoxes, now I think Lantronics, Burke, a lot of people use these WTI. They're RS-232 boxes. Basically, it's IP-based RS-232. It encapsulates the RS-232. So we can use a lot of our legacy equipment that we used to have to just use dial-up modem or dial-up connections. We can do that over IP. So that gives us a layer of control that we never had before. Many of our devices, like the on-air monitors, everything from the like our De Sequoia receivers or Golden Eagle, some of those kind of things have the ability, many, many devices that we have now have the ability to send email alerts and those kind of things over IP. So it's just really a, you know, it's a huge change. I tell people, I laugh, I came to Vermont Public Radio in 1997. When I walked into the term room, there wasn't even an Ethernet jack in the term room. You know, the program director was sending playlists to a website using a dial-up modem to a VAX machine, which was across the state at Dartmouth, where they'd given us an account. I mean, that's the kind of thing, you know, the rapid change that we've had. We are very, very hopeful for more modern technologies like MPLS and those kind of things, which apparently are now coming into the state through some of the phone carriers, kind of these virtual Ethernet circuits, which are very common for our colleagues in the cities who have already been able to use these kind of things. And that's just now coming into Vermont. We're just on the verge of bringing up a 10 meg circuit between our studios in Colchester and our studios in Norwich, which is across the state near Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. So it's almost 100 miles, but it's a 10 meg circuit on fiber. So those are the kind of things that we look forward to in the future of being able to, have these kind of sonnet rings and those kind of things that we can reach our sites across the state. Then, coupled with our colleagues at Vermont Public Television who are able to give us some access on their microwave, and of course then the off-air pickups. And we also use a number of cell devices. Cellular is just one of many devices where we found it problematic to have landlines because it's such hostile environments for copper wires that we use these boxes, which are basically devices that are cell phones that output an analog, for lack of a better word, an analog connection. So we can, for instance, call up our remote control, our Burke systems, using this cellular device, and the equipment thinks it's talking to an analog phone. So it's kind of a real mix. We look forward to, increasing technology. Vermont's been very, very proactive in trying to put forth, sort of a broadband initiative for the whole state. So it's a mix right now, but I think it's only going to get better.
I think that's true. I think it is going to get better as time goes on. We're kind of leaving some of the bad old days of internet connectivity. And I think overall, and I say internet, networking connectivity. Sure, there may be laws being implemented about net neutrality, but hopefully those won't affect things like private connections that you buy through a carrier to connect yourself to other sites. Hey, Rich, we had some questions from the chat room, but I think you've really answered some of those. A good friend from Canada wants to know more about what kind of WAN services that you're able to buy from your carrier, and is it switched Ethernet? Is it akin to Metro Ethernet? Is MPLS involved to give you some quality of service controls on that? Can you describe a bit more about the service?
Yeah, right now we again this gets into just the fact that some of the engineers at the ISP or people that I've known who worked at like three generations of ISPs back and, who bought who, and they keep working. But the relationships are, I'm not sure if it's true every single place in the country, but here in Vermont, relationships are probably as important as anything, more important than technology in some respects. So while we're waiting for MPLS, and we've been promised that it'll be delivered very soon, the fact of the matter is that, as I said, we have these direct internet access T1s that are basically just like an IP internet, if you were saying, well, I just want some internet. But there, somebody at the switch knows to just plug that cable into the other cable that goes to the router that goes to our transmitter site. And that simulates, point-to-point link. And a lot of that depends on just the relationships that we have with people in the state and at these companies. But yes, we have been promised that things like the MPLS, there's a product, I can't remember the name of it, EtherPath or something like that, but these are managed Ethernet pipes that can be sliced and diced and pointed at different places. It's very important for disaster recovery for us because we can have a studio in Montpelier, we can have a studio in Norwich, and if our Colchester studio goes down, we can feed all of our sites through IP and have it routed to our other sites. So yes, it's I hope that answers the question, but I think that's exactly the direction that we're hoping to go.
Yeah, I think it does. So VPR covers Vermont pretty well at this point, or do you have plans for any more sites, fill-in sites? You got any big plans afoot as far as transmission?
Yeah, we're thinking of taking over all of Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, and most of Canada. No, no, seriously, we have been very fortunate. We cover, I would say, probably 85-90% of Vermont right now, and that's because of some very active work by myself, support from our board, and our management team in working with either acquiring sites through auctions, through some of these windows. We have a lot of translator networks. We've had some acquisitions, not many, but a couple of acquisitions that have been key for us. And so, yeah, I think we really are trying to provide a service to all of the people of Vermont. And I think we're getting very, very close to that. We just received a CP in the latest round, and MX was settled in Brattleboro. That was a big area in the southern part of the state that we could not cover. We've been trying to cover that for, gosh, I don't know, 20 years. And we just couldn't, you know, I mean, we talked to people, will you sell us a station down here? Well, you know, what can we do? And there just wasn't an opportunity. And we finally got this CP for Brattleboro. And that was, you know, that was a big piece of, you know, covering Vermont for us.
And by MX, you mean that's mutually exclusive. So somebody else.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. Not to be so inside ball. But basically, the in the last window, there was a lot of applications, and we applied for a service in Brattleboro, and we did win that on what they call points, most for service, you know, technical showings and all that. And that's a lot of the work that I've been doing over the past, I'd say, 5 years. Some of these applications, first with the opening of the translators from, if I can say this, translators from HowlRound were, I don't know, what, 3,000, 3,500 applications were turned in. We were able to get, I think, 12 of those to fill in over the state. And those have been very big for us. I have to give a shout out to Ira Wilner down in the southern part of Vermont, who turned me on to the notion of using translators to rebroadcast HD2. And, of course, the FCC confirmed that in the case in Syracuse, I think, New York, or in the midst of upstate New York. So what that meant was we could take some of these 10-watt translators and boost them up to 250 watts as fill-in translators and broadcast the HD2. Because, see, in Vermont, we decided a while back that there was a very, very strong demand. As a public radio station, we used to do the typical kind of tent pole, they used to call it, public radio programming. There was Morning Edition, which is a news and information block, and there was classical music from 9 to 3, and then we went back to sort of news and information. And a lot of our surveys and studies showed that people really wanted to hear either just news or either classical music. Mm-hmm. So we took a risk and we made a step a few years back to try to split the network. And that's going very well. And so now we're able to cover most of the state with our news and information and our classical. And so what HD has done for us is we counter-program our HD signals on the different stations. The classical station will have the Vermont News and Information Service on its HD2, and similarly the news and information station will have classical on the HD2. And so then we are able to use translators to fill in those areas where we don't have good coverage for one or other of the services, and by using them as filing them as a fill-in, we can go above the 10 watts and you really do a very good job you know, and trying to serve our listeners with the services they want. And it's done well for us. You know, without getting too political, they say that the number one determination, I guess, of who will listen to public radio classical stations is not income, not location. There's no indicator that is more predictive than education level. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be a relatively high level of education of people in Vermont, and so we've done very well with the classical service in a, frankly, a service that is kind of dying in a lot of places in the country, but it's done very well for us.
Good, good. Hey, Tom. Tom had a question to return to the icing subject. Tom, what was that?
Hey, Rich. You know, but we saw it before. We saw pictures of Mount Washington with a lot of ice on there. And for those who are listening to this rather than watching, think of the worst ice you've probably seen outside your door. Then multiply it by a minimum of 10. I mean, we're talking some serious ice. And
you're talking about yesterday, then, Tom. Is that what
you're yeah, exactly. But we're talking. And for those who aren't into FM broadcast, and for those you know, watching the TWRT presentation on TWIT right now, we basically have two ways of de-icing an FM antenna. Someone opined, "Hey, why don't we just get a flamethrower?" Well, I'd love to have a flamethrower, but you know, my wife won't let me because she knows what I do with it. The two ways we have electric de-icers, which basically is an electric heating element wrapped around or buried inside the antenna element, which I think is about 100 watts, maybe less than that. And then there's also what you referred to, Rich, as the radome. And what a radome is, it looks like, in many cases, it looks like an oil drum. But what it is, it's a big fiberglass covering. And the intent is to keep the ice off of the antenna element. I guess my question for you is, taking a look at that Mount Washington photo, I'm assuming that you've got some experience with both the radomes and the de-icers. And my guess is those de-icers don't do a heck of a lot with RIME ice. Am I correct? The electronic.
One of the biggest things that de-icers do is they create a very wonderful column of heated water inside a column of ice. That's all I can say about it. They just don't work. Not in environments like we have. We tried them on one side, and frankly, they just simply do not work. We get so much ice that what we found is that we have is just sort of this warm water sort of piling up inside of this huge column of ice, and it does nothing.
And Tom, I'm going to say, Rich, I'm guessing that they say that the proper way to use electric de-icers is to turn them on before the icing starts. But if the ice accumulation is so fast, I'm guessing that it overcomes the de-icer's ability to keep the element from icing up. And then you do have just what you described. You get warm water inside a column, a cap, a surrounding of ice. And you really haven't kept the antenna from getting detuned in that situation.
No, that's true. I think that there's probably, faster math heads than me that could, take the surface area of an FM antenna, calculate the caloric emissions from a de-icer, put it up against the temperature and the icing, and they would just show that it's just never going to win. I mean, my wife and I were having a good time the other day. It was 35 below at the house. Now, we're at, 1,200 feet, not up on the mountain. We're like 1,200 feet. And we went out at 6:30 in the morning because of some friends in Alaska who had told us about this trick. And we took a tea kettle full of boiling water and we poured it into a coffee cup. And I took a picture of my wife, a video of her, basically throwing this water straight up into the air. And it just instantly froze into a mist of ice crystals. I mean, instantly. Wow. So now that was boiling water. I mean, it came out of the teapot bubbling into the cup. She threw it up in the air and it instantly turned. So now if you think about that in terms of a tower site where you have wind, as a parenthesis, we work, there's a company in Vermont called NRG. And what they do is they make wind monitoring equipment for the wind power industry. So they have a lot of anemometers, I think it is, up on top of our tower sites. Mount Mansfield, one particularly bad winter, they clocked speeds of over 120 miles an hour before the thing basically just broke apart. And that was also the winter that it blew a six-bay Shively array around the leg of the tower and bent the transmission line. But that's another horrible story. But the point is that with that kind of wind, with that kind of cold, I can't even imagine a de-icer that would be effective, that wouldn't essentially melt the Teflon in the transmission line.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
if you look at Mount Washington, if you look at our Brick Mountain site, and I'm sorry, I don't have a picture of that. I was looking to see if I could share that with you. Really, the only true solution is the radome, and that is to keep the ice as far away from the antenna elements as possible, and to just count on the physics to be able to, to keep it. I'm looking at the chat. I hope you don't mind, but I saw someone said rubber boots with pressurized air to expand them. I tell you, that is something that has crossed my mind a number of times because I've seen that on airplanes, on the leading edge of airplanes, a lot of, not so much for FM antennas, but I thought somebody, I just wish somebody would come up with that for satellite dishes and for microwave dishes. Mm-hmm. Now, I did see a company, and I'm sorry, I can't call their name, and you know, it doesn't matter, but they had a dish cover, and I saw them at NAB, and I thought, I just wanted to hug the guy. I said, this is brilliant. It had a bunch of shakers around the edge of this dish cover that were just basically motors that were sort of unbalanced, and they shook the shaker, and it would just shake the dish cover and knock some of the ice off.
Yeah, and of course, it's shaking the dish cover, and the cover itself is flexible. So if you shake it, it can move.
Right,
whereas
exactly.
The dish itself, you'd have to shake it so hard to get it to move.
No, you've really, in that case, I mean, you have to have a dish cover. Now, I mean, I don't want to digress too much, but we have, you know, we have microwave dishes, and we have satellite dishes to get our NPR programming. And I will tell you that the snow that we've had today, it really doesn't do anything to the microwave. I mean, they go out and then they, you know, they knock it off and it's fine. But I can tell you that if it were to get warmer and we would get just a tiny drizzle and like an eighth of an inch of ice on a dish cover, mm-hmm. all bets are off. We'd lose the signal completely. Yeah. So our people have to go out there and basically kind of bang on the dish cover gently with with a big rake or something to just dislodge the ice, because that is a huge problem for any kind of parabolic receiver. Is that thin layer of ice. More than snow, more than anything else, it's that thin layer of ice that basically changes the focal point.
Yep, absolutely. It sure does. Found that out in Mississippi. Ended up pointing, you know, one of those barn heaters that looks like a jet engine?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I ended up pointing one of those at a dish outside during a great Mississippi ice storm a few years ago. And after about 4 or 5 hours, I had enough clear dish to get a signal again.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Hard to get heat when you got no, you know, when you're not in a building, when you're outside.
I see Tom's got a question on weight and wind load. Do you want me to take that real quick?
Rich, just what I was going to ask is, you know, when we usually spec things out, I mean, we take a look, if we're going to put an FM antenna on the tower, we take a look at the dead weight of the FM antenna, and then now we're going to put radomes on it. So we take a look and we say, okay, now we're going to add the weight of the radomes to that dead weight. And they usually spec it with like a half inch of ice, and they figure the weight of the ice, and that gives you the total weight of the antenna system. I was going to say, what is your normal spec for like Mount Mansfield?
I like 4 inches of it. No. Actually, it turns out that what we found out is actually that there is a point in the icing formula. Now, this relates mostly to wind load, but there's a point at which it just, you know, becomes solid, and so you can stop calculating, if you know what I mean. Now, of course, the weight is a big issue, but I think that for a large number of towers, they're really designed to take a very high compressive load, and you know, so the weight turns out to be not quite. I mean, it's not that it's unimportant and they have to calculate it, but it turns out that the weight itself is not the real factor. The real issue is wind load. And particularly on our sites where we're co-located with cell towers, the tower studies that I've had done and the people that I've talked to have said far and away their biggest concern are the transmission lines, because they provide these, especially if you look at a cell site that's got 12, you know, to 18 lines, you might as well just figure the tower is solid.
Yeah.
In terms of wind load. And that's where their concern is, more so than weight. Not that weight isn't important. We saw a terrible incident across the Lake Champlain where the television, North Mountain Lakes TV lost their big tower, you know, due to ice. So it's not that it's unimportant. But the wind load and the flex and those kind of things are just definitely, you know, a huge problem. And I will say that, you know, I'm not a structural engineer, but I can tell you that if you get something that turns into a solid and then you get wind, what you get is a vortex shedding. And that's a really serious problem. What that is, those of you who know something about aerodynamics, if you have a wind going around a solid object, just like a wing of an airplane, what you get is a vacuum on the other side of it. And that's what causes lift in a wing, right? So what happens is it pulls the tower into that vacuum, and then, of course, eventually it breaks that vacuum, and then the tower shrinks back, and what you get is an oscillation of that tower. And that is really the most dangerous and the most critical problem. That's why you'll see on large smokestacks and some huge TV antenna and stuff, you'll see that sort of a spiral I don't know, like a wing on it, like a inclined plane wrapped around
I've seen
it.
Them. Those what
are,
that was.
Yeah, those are called strakes, and what those are supposed to do is to break up that wind to prevent vortex shedding.
Yeah.
So what it does is it makes it non-aerodynamic so that it doesn't get a vacuum behind it, which causes the oscillation, which can just tear down a tower just through the oscillations.
Sounds like they break up the laminar flow of wind around something like a smokestack. And there's similar things for airplane wings that help the if you can control the laminar flow, you can make the airplane take off and stall at a lower speed. So probably some of the
I'm going to step away. My pager is going crazy, so I'm going to get it off of the counter. It just jumped off the counter in vibrate mode. Hang on 1 second.
All right. Hey, guys, we're actually going to come to the end of our show here pretty soon. It sounds like Rich is a guy that we need to have back on the show sometime, maybe in a nicer time of the year, in the summertime, when he can tell us about the wildlife and the birds sweetly singing on Mount Ascutney and people doing what's parasailing or what do they do off Mount Ascutney?
It's not parasailing. What is that called? Now, hang gliding.
Hang gliding. That's it. Hang gliding.
Yeah, there's a beautiful hang gliding site at Mount Ascutney. Just a really gorgeous, gorgeous site.
Even better if you jump from the tower.
No, you know, it turns out that that's not such a good idea. Well, because there's these things called guy wires.
Yes.
Wicked dangerous those things are.
You're bothering us with details, Rich.
Yeah, I know.
Hey, we're going to have to draw the show to a close here in just a second. Hey, Mr. Tobin, you got anything else for Rich today, and especially in this topical bad weather subject we've been talking about?
I'm just curious with the temperatures you spoke of and the boiling water that froze into a mist of ice. What is it like working at the transmitter site on the overnights when you have to shut down the transmitters, which are a source of heat in some facilities? And do you have a special heating capabilities at your transmitter building? You know, I'm just curious because, you know, Tom and I, it gets cold in our buildings, but I'm sure it's nothing like you experience at your place.
Well, fortunately, we don't have to do a lot of overnights, but we are very, very fortunate at almost all of our sites that we're co-located with some really big TV transmitters, so they pretty much do the job for us.
Guys, I want to finish up here, and I want to give Rich just a second to talk about something near and dear to his heart, and that is the Association of Public Radio Engineers. They have a website that we've shown on Rich's lower third, APRE.us. Rich, you're a founding board member of this organization. What's that all about?
The Association of Public Radio Engineers, I'm moving out of the picture here. I want you to see the 3.5 feet of snow on my deck here. I hope you can see that. I just opened the door. It's real snow there. So, the APRE is the Association of Public Radio Engineers. It came out of the NPR public radio conferences that used to be done every year, and it the engineering folks took over the role of doing technical presentations for engineers in the public radio network to try to promote education and to help us with learning our skills and sharing and things. And one of the things that APR does that I'm particularly proud of and is that we offer at least one, if not more, scholarships every year to young engineers. And I use the word young advisedly. I don't mean necessarily that they have to be physically young, but people who are new to the field. So what we've done is we've offered scholarships through basically vendor contributions and other contributions so that people can come to these sessions. These are held usually the 2 days before NAB on a Thursday and Friday with a dinner on Saturday nights. And they talk about, Kirk, you were a guest at one of them. We talked about audio over IP. Mm-hmm. We have transmitter manufacturers. We have I was talking about some of these IP radios. We had people from RAD. We had people, which is the pseudo-wire. They do encapsulate legacy stuff like T1s and ISDN and all that kind of stuff over T1 radios. We have a number of supporting vendors that provide support for the organization. And what we do is we try to provide the best education we can for public radio engineers to maintain their skills and also to learn from each other at these sessions. So that's, I think, in large part what APRE does. It's not meant to supplant, you know, what SVE or some of the others does, but because sometimes there are some unique challenges and concerns, both in terms of technology and also in terms of budget, for public radio engineers, then we have this forum where we can get together. So APRE tries to fill that gap.
Cool. And look, you have a website. It's APRE.us. And
right.
Folks can go there and read all about it, see what's coming up just for the NAB show this year. Looks like April, 7th and 8th you guys are meeting? Yeah,
that's,
April 7th
and 8th. That's correct, Kirk. And you'll notice we have a call for papers. We love to hear from people, vendors, other engineers, people that have things to say. You know, we've had really good presentations on here's a facility that I built, here's how it went, here's the things I learned, here's the red check marks and things you never want to do again, you know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's been very, very gratifying. And I got to say, you know, I mean, I guess I'm getting to be an old fart, but when I look and I see a young person, a young man or young woman who's there, who's never been to something like this, and they're just starting out in the business, and they're able to rub shoulders with people with 10, 20, 30, 40 years of experience because of a scholarship to this thing, it, you know, there's not a lot of people getting into this business. And it's really great to see their excitement and to see them, you know, the kind of just their eyes light up when they see some of these things and they talk to some of these people and heck, you know, hear some of our old fart stories.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't one of them, and it was very educational, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your members, and I've learned a lot, too, listening to the other panelists who were on that day. Guys, we got to wrap it up, and Rich, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate you taking your time on short notice to join us and chat about radio engineering. Thanks a lot.
It's all right. I'm going to go outside now. I got to plow another 5 or 6 inches out of my driveway, so it was a good break before I do that.
Well, good luck with that. Hey, Chris Tobin in Manhattan, thank you also for being with us. Appreciate you.
No problem. Thank you, as always. It's a pleasure. I'm just having more of my wine.
Oh, and I had tea tonight. Oh, well, got to maintain my sobriety here, at least to some extent. And Tom Ray from WOR in the Hudson Valley of New York. Thanks for being with us, Tom. Thanks for your questions, too.
Thanks for having me, Kirk. And I'm not having wine, but I am whining about the snow. But anyway.
Well, hey, guys, Kirk, I hope you don't mind, but I just want to say I really appreciate being on tonight. And Tom and all the guys, you know, I just really appreciate Chris and Tom. Our colleagues in commercial radio, you guys are just really, you know, are a model for us. And I appreciate the work that you do and the kind of pressure that you're under. And it means a lot to be able to be able to talk to you guys. So thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
Yeah, same here, Rich. Thanks. And we enjoy learning from you, too. So,
all right, guys. We're going to be back next week for another edition of This Week in Radio Tech. You can listen to our show by subscribing to it in the iTunes store. Just search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T, and you'll find it there. You can go to our website, thisweekinradiotech.com, and you can download the show from there. You can click on the RSS button and get the feed that way if you like. You can also listen to the show with a player right on the website. Also, you can go to our Facebook page. If you just go to your Facebook and do a search for TWIRT, T-W-I-R-T, we should pop right up there. Like us, friend us, whatever it is you do on Facebook, and you can also be kept up to date when a new episode is released there. We'll post it on Facebook within a few minutes of posting the actual edited episode. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you very much. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
This episode has been brought to you exclusively by Omnia, the Omnia 1, the Omnia 6, and the Omnia 11. Check them out on the web at omniaaudio.com.
That's all the bandwidth we can pilfer this week. Another TWIRT has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes Store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here.
Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penny LePay Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.